controls working them on vertical or horizontal. I don't know what really took place here, but it's something to think about. Taking a vertical antenna and turning it into a big question mark and all, is that really going to make the performance of a vertical 3 to 4 dB better, no matter whether you are working people horizontally or vertically or whatever, which way the wonder take over?
Yeah, I hear you. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on all this. KC2QRQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'm not that familiar with this antenna, Dick, but what I am doing is just reading these articles, and some of them are in German, some of them are in English. But basically, I think with the to sum up what these articles are saying is that if you're going to build, let's say, a three-element Yagi, you can achieve what they're claiming from these articles is about a little bit over 11 dBi or somewhere around 8 dB of 8 dBd of gain, which is kind of unheard of for a three-element Yagi. And what they're saying is pretty much that you're not going to gain a whole heck of a lot more in terms of directivity out of this antenna by adding a lot more elements. As a matter of fact, it pretty much suggests otherwise. But if they were looking at, like, if you were to use full-size dipole elements and compare the size, they're saying that the Lansdorfer Yagi is about 20% smaller than the full-size dipole because of the shape and the geometry of the antenna. But they are saying that with three elements you can achieve, this is, you know, this is what's written here, you know, a little bit more than 11 dBi. Leave it, you've got the article now, Dick, so have fun. KC2QIQ.
I haven't read very much of it, but this article on this three-element Yagi, they are claiming 11 dBi for that antenna on figure number one. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, it's saying right here, the gain of the realized antenna as a function of frequency is shown in figure five. The maximal value is 11.6 dBi. It's pretty neat for a three-element beam.
Yeah, I see figure five, and I do see gain, dBi, and I see just a skosh below 12 at frequency of something like 6.3 gigahertz. And that's for a three-element Yagi?
Yes, sir.
And by the way, the little triangles, I think, represent the real data, and the smooth black curve represents the smooth equivalent. And some of those little triangles hit 12 at 6.2 gigahertz.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating is how they describe the E and the H plane and what's really happening with these elements. And basically the gain, what they're actually finding is not only this, the side lobe suppression is better than 22 dB in the H field and 12 dB in the E plane, which is also very, very interesting for a three-element Yagi. Boy, I wish my three-element Yagi did that.
W2YY.
Yeah, the H-plane pattern, which is 4A, looks very broad in the front, and 4B looks very fine for the E-plane. Joe, I wonder if you have any experience with this one. W2RYY, go ahead.
No, since you're talking about Yagis, I was going to ask you something in reference to this kind of antenna. If you had a Yagi, say, if you couldn't find one in the right frequency band anymore, you wanted one to operate for, say, 420 to 440, and you couldn't find that particular model made anymore. They made 450 to 470 and 406 to 420. If you got one that was a 406 to 420 and modified all the antenna lengths so they were identical to the antenna lengths of the model from 420 to 440, what would happen? Would the gain be reduced slightly or the directivity be reduced slightly? What do you think on that?
Okay. I've got a little bit of confusion as to what you're asking, but I will tell you that if I took a Yagi on frequency A, change every single dimension, diameters, spacings, lengths, whatever. If I changed every single spacing proportional to the new wavelength I care about, in theory, I get the exact same gain on the new frequency. Now, if you're only changing element lengths without changing element positions, time, you will not achieve that. Back to you, Joe.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, because in a case of this type of antenna, the elements are welded to the boom. So if you buy a lower frequency model, the elements are spaced a little further apart from each other. You can't change that.
Now, with those elements welded to the boom, if you go to a real good modeling program, you'll get 95% of the performance if you properly readjust the lens of the elements. But it's going to be a slightly different design. There's nothing exactly magic about the spacing of the elements. You could use the same elements with a slightly different length configuration, slightly different length profile, and you will come up with at least 95% of that performance. But it's going to take some modeling to get there. Just dumbly changing all the elements is not going to do it. Because to make the right velocity profile down that boom is a combination of element lengths and element positions. And it's more difficult if you're only changing element lengths. I didn't say impossible, more difficult. Back to you, Joe.
Well, that was my question. On a good guess, what do you think would happen? Would you sacrifice a little bit of gain or sacrifice a little bit of directivity?
There's no difference between gain and directivity. If the antenna is made out of lossless materials, gain and directivity are the exact same thing. If you've got lossy elements in the antenna, then you can have a beautiful pattern and lousy gain. If I built a phased array of, let's say, 16 dipoles, and instead of putting on the 16 dipoles in the array, I put in 16 50-ohm resistors, and the resistors are set up in such a way that they're slightly leaky dipoles, if you know what I mean, I'll have almost the exact same pattern. I'll just happen to have 16 dB less gain. So there's a difference in directivity and gain when you've got loss. But if there's no loss, the only method by which an antenna can give you gain is by taking the power from some directions and redirecting it like a flashlight in the desired direction. That's the directivity pattern. So for lossless antennas, and if you and I build a Yagi correctly, you put 100 watts into it, it's going to run ice cold. Therefore, it's lossless. Therefore, gain and directivity have to be the same thing. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, maybe I was just phrasing it wrong or incorrectly here. The problem is with the particular type of antenna, I'd like to use one in the 420 and 440 band, but the manufacturer doesn't make this antenna anymore. And I found a couple of manufacturers that make this type of antenna, don't make it in that frequency band anymore, okay? So the only way to get something that's going to operate close to that is to buy an antenna at a lower frequency and make the element shorter, okay? That brings the thing probably more within resonance than it was before. What's going to happen with the gain compared to if it was operated in band compared to slightly out of band as far as the length and the spacing of the elements, because that you can't change. That's basically the question I'm asking.
Yeah. Assuming that they don't build the antenna on the band that you want, 420 to 450, but they build a lower frequency version and a higher frequency version, in theory, you're better off choosing the higher frequency version, because if I plot Yagi gain versus frequency, and I start off at the desirable frequency of highest gain, called the center of the band. And if I sweep myself up in frequency, it falls off eventually like a cliff. If I sweep lower in frequency, it falls off in a much slower, controlled manner. The bottom line of all that is, if you did nothing to the Yagi, just dumbly use it, using it on a lower frequency, if I go 20% low in frequency, I'm going to get a hell of a lot more performance than if I go 20% high in frequency. That's just the way Yagis behave. So starting off high and moving it lower, just by going there without even retuning it, is going to give you a lot of performance. Then if you put telescoping pieces of tubing at the end of each of the elements to extend their length, you're going to pick up 95% of the performance you had at the higher frequency, in my opinion, if you do it right. Your next question is, how do you do it right? And the answer is a good modeling program. Back to you, Joe.
Well,
of defeats what I had in mind, really. I thought of doing it the other way because of just basically because of neatness, to have the antenna, you know, actually physically shorter. And the only thing that couldn't be changed was obviously the boom length and the spacing of the elements on the boom itself. The boom is maybe 2 inches longer or something like that between one model antenna and the other. That's all I was getting at. Would I lose a lot of gain, a little bit of gain? That's all. That's all the question really was.
Okay, 2 inches longer for how many elements? Are you talking about a 3-element Yagi or a 16-element Yagi? Back to you, Joe.
I believe the antenna basically is a 7-element Yagi, so I think that's typically, what, 10 dBd?
Okay, 7 elements, and it's only 2 inches longer if you buy the lower one. Maybe we're into the minutia here. That's a rather small difference. The whole Don antenna is, what, 6 feet long?
No, I have to look up the exact specification of the antenna. To actually know what it is. It's I think the 406 to 420 model is about, it's either 34 or 37 inches long, and it was like about just like I think 2 or 3 inches less than that. But I mean, I can come back next technique, like next week, and give you the more specific information on the particular antenna itself between like the lower frequency compared to the higher frequency. But it's not very much in difference in the length of the boom length, because that's something I do tell you.
Do you have any technique for any capability of measuring gain of the antenna? Could you do some kind of a side-by-side test, Joe?
I've never tried to measure gain on an antenna. That's pretty much your department, not mine. I've never tried to do that at all.
But I have visited your QTH. You have the resources. You've got more than enough property to set up a reflective ground plane antenna range, following the appropriate chapter out of the antenna handbook. And it's a chapter on, is it on transmission lines and testing? They've got it in a funny place. But the chapter on antenna testing by W2IMU, you read that chapter. Most of it's written in English. It's not a super complicated chapter. You've got more than enough property to do it, Joe. Go ahead.
I've often thought about that, but don't you get into problems when you're measuring something at very, very high frequency and measuring something at some sort of distance away from it, from a fixed location, that even the position of the antenna, even minutely changing, could change something with a reflection of how you're receiving the signal from one antenna to another when you go to change antennas, thusly that would throw off your measurements?
Good guess, but no. When you properly set up a ground plane antenna range, reflective ground plane antenna range, you're using the ground reflection in your favor. You're not fighting it. Common sense would lead you to believe you set up the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna both as high as you can get across away from the ground so you avoid ground reflection. Common sense would lead you to do that. And unless you can put it half a mile high, it doesn't work. If you intentionally set up the transmitting antenna very low to the ground, from the point of view of the antenna under test, it cannot tell the difference between the real antenna above ground and the reflected antenna below the ground, the mirror image. They look like one antenna. The inside of the main lobe, so to speak. So when you do that correctly, it is not very sensitive to positions of things. I will admit, if you got a great big reflecting object on the left side of the range or the right side of the range, life gets complicated. I think you can find a place in your yard where that may not be. It may have to be the front yard. You may have to put up with the neighbors laughing at you, but I think you've got the resources, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, I was just posing the question just from a theoretical standpoint. If the antenna had so much gain at a certain frequency and you change the element length, is the gain really going to start dropping significantly or just a slight bit? Enough to worry about or enough to not worry about?
I'm not positive, but for the percentages of frequencies you're talking about moving, just by changing the element length proportional to wavelength, I think you're going to get 95% of the performance you want. Go ahead.
Okay. That was the answer I guess I was looking for, 95%. That's good enough for me.
Yeah, I've done a lot of backyard Yagi antenna tuning on 16 through 19 element Yagis. I rapidly came to the conclusion that element lengths are quite sensitive. element positions are very insensitive when you move them one or two at a time. Where I don't have experience is moving all of them like you're doing. But you're moving them all by a very small percentage. I think there's a high probability you're going to get away with it. I think it's going to work like a charm. If I were you, I would go for it. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, Dick. Could you put me on the list?
You're on the list. Let's see now. I almost thought I had an APG before. No, it was MPG. MPJ. Oh, well, that's close. Let me make sure that Mel and I have almost answered this latest set of letters he's gotten last week and this week on Lansdorf. I don't think we got the whole story yet, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. No, we haven't got the whole story, because now I'm going to talk about what Chip, who was on the TV, Channel 13 program that started all these questions that I'm getting, what he said and what he did. And he said now one of his experiments, with fractal antennas, he said he wanted to hit a repeater with his 1-watt handy talkie, I'm quoting here, 2-meter FM, wanted to continuous link to my DX packet cluster using my 1-watt handy talkie, which was more than 35 miles away from where I lived. And I could not do this with any antennas up to the time I decided to sit down using glue construction paper and aluminum foil and went ahead and duplicated the Minkowski Island fractal design. Are you familiar with the Minkowski Island? Well, there's a number of now. Listen, gee, Minkowski Island. They got an M11 design, an M12 design, and a whole list of different designs of these fractal antennas using Minkowski design. And then they got it as a comparison to a reference quad, and supposedly these antennas are outperforming them by, I have to question these gains, Dick. I can't see over a quad 5.4 dB by going to this Minkowski Island design over.
Wow. How many element antenna are we talking about, Mel? And I presume his motivation was that he was living in an apartment building or whatever where they wouldn't allow him to put up an antenna that they could see. So he wants to build something that is physically small, essentially invisible, but yet has the same performance. So he used this Minkowski Island design. He shrunk down the antenna. Did he say how many elements he used to get all this extra gain? Back to you, Mel.
It looks like I got a sketch of it here. The Minkowski design, let's see, which one did he use? Let me see. Did he use M11 or M12? I think he used M12, because I see the picture of it. It is a bit of a complicated sit-down. I guess with tinfoil, you could duplicate this. I see if you had a, you know, really were construction with tinfoil on paper and all, and sketched it out and then traced it with the tinfoil. I guess you could do this. But according to this, in other words, he took a single element quad, originally just a quad type of Endfire quad for broadside, I guess. Wait a minute. Quad. I guess what would be quad would be, I guess would be an Endfire single element quad, and then he built this M11 Minkowski. Would that now constitute a broadside? You know, I'm not sure, Dick. I'm very confused with all this. Maybe you straighten me out. What is a Minkowski Island design, if you know anything about it? And is it broadside or Endfire, over?
Now, before I answer that, let's back up. When you're talking about quad, is quad a contraction of cubical quad? Is it a single, one-wavelength diameter cubical quad that was his reference antenna, or was it a cubical quad Yagi made out of three or four elements? What was the reference antenna before he went to fractal, if you happen to know, Mel? Go ahead.
According to what I can gather, it was just a, I guess he called it a quad type of the element. In other words, using that as a single, you know, square. I guess he called it, you know, for reference, call it a quad element. It's a single element because he was trying it from, like he says, from his apartment. Here's where his whole problem was. He was living in an apartment, and the landlord, exactly the way he said it on the TV program, the landlord would not permit him to put up anything that that, you know, would permit him to put up any kind of a, let's see, more importantly, the antenna would not have tracked my landlord, because he said no antennas in my clause. And so he tried a number of different designs. In other words, he started out with a sort of a square element antenna. I guess he can call it a quad element. And then wound up with this Minkowski Island, which outperformed it, Dick, over.
Okay. I could make what you and I would call a square loop, a full wavelength square loop. I can feed it in the square manner or the diamond manner. If I laid it horizontal and opened up one end and fed it, it'd be a horizontally polarized antenna. If I closed the loop entirely and fed it with a delta match, gamma match, or whatever, and set it up so that the single loop is perpendicular to the ground, and I'm using it broadside, in other words, in the plane, if I draw a normal to the plane of this one element, one wavelength, square wire thing, I'm using a one element cubical quad, and then instead of building this one wavelength square, one wavelength long square shaped wire thing, I build an equivalent thing out of this Minkowski Island, which is really a fancy way of meandering. So now I can get the one wavelength of electrical length in a much smaller physical area. Everything I know about the physics of squeezing an antenna down in physical number of wavelengths tells me that the gain will not increase. He may have thought he saw gain increase. I'm having a lot of trouble with that one, Mel, but maybe I'm misunderstanding. Back to you, K2RIW.
This is kind of complicated to understand. He said he started out with a zero iteration of a Minkowski Island. Now, what the heck does he mean? Oh, I see. In other words, when it's a zero Minkowski Island, it actually looks like a quad. In other words, it's an actual quad, full-size quad for 2 meters, one element. Now, you take that same piece, that same thing, now you start to so-called modify it by making it into a crazy shape, you know, this iteration. First iteration of Minkowski Island is an M11. In other words, you took the quad and now you start bending it. Instead of keeping it square, you start making it into this intricate pattern. And he says by doing that, he was able now to, well, his tests were that now he could can have continuous link to the CX packet cluster using my 1-watt handy talkie, which I could not do before with any of the antennas that I was capable of installing. And this includes trying a quarter wave vertical, which did not work at all. Then the quad element, he calls it the zero iteration quad element, until he bent it into this Minkowski Island, he was not able to maintain contact with the packet station with the 1-watt handy talkie. It was, he said, unbelievable, because I did not have anything to really go by. Just by following mathematically whatever I can understand about this Minkowski Island iteration, Dick, over.
Yeah, was this higher iteration Minkowski, was the basic one a square with a square hole in the middle, and then you take that pattern, make it much small, much, much smaller, and do a step and repeat across the page, horizontally and vertically. And as you go to higher and higher iterations, you're taking a smaller and smaller pattern and doing a step and repeat across the page. Is that what the higher iterations look like, Mel? Go ahead.
Hey, Lex thought, I'm looking at the picture of it. He got the picture. He sent me the picture here from Communications Quarterly of Chip's M13 2-meter, 8 inches on a side. He said, small enough I could stick it out the window even. And I'm looking at this thing. Actually, it's basically you took a piece of wire, started out with it in a square, a perfect square, now took the open end of it and started now to make these patterns. That's basically what you're looking at, Dick. In other words, I don't know, how can I describe it? These Minkowski Islands, they are, I guess you looked at it, you say, I don't know what that is. This guy must be into modern art or something. But I never believe this is an antenna, over.
Okay, so the piece of wire got zigzagged in a very elaborate manner. I'll give you that. But when he finished, this 2-meter antenna was 8 inches wide and 8 inches high. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
It's 8 inches on a side. My picture, M13, Minkowski M13, designed for 2 meters. Is 8 inches on a side, and he says so that now, he says it's easy, I could even stick it out the window and use it. And he claims that with this type of antenna, let me look up, let's see, what does he claim? Well, the reference quad, when he first started out with it in that so-called quad square piece of wire before he started twisting it up, and 144 megahertz, he then, with LNEC modeling it, he says he thinks it looks like 2.8 dB high. After you go through the bending of it in the M11 type of configuration, it winds up from 2.8, it wound up at 3.5 dBi. And if you go to M12 design, it winds up at, let me see if I can find on the chart here, it winds up at 5.4 dBi. So it went from 2.8 to 5.4. Is that possible by bending a piece of wire, Dick, over?
My first impression is absolutely not. Did the final version, the 12th inversion or whatever it's called, did the outer dimensions of that final bent-up piece of wire, was it 8 inches wide and 8 inches high? And he's radiating broadside from it. Am I correct on that one, Mel? Go ahead.
Probably 8 inches on a side. That's what he says here. And he shows a picture of it, and he says you can stick it out the window. Yeah, looks like some kid, you know, sat down and had a good time with a piece of hanger wire, whatever. I can't believe this, what I'm reading here, that is there some magic going on here? I don't know. I don't know what to say. But he modeled it, and then his further later on, Chip, I guess we can, his modeling was done by ELNEC, LNEC, and he says he has a whole bunch of charts that were derived for the Minkowski Island different quad design elements. In other words, starting out with the what he calls the zero iteration, which is the square, and then after you go to the different design, the M11, M12 designs, M13, what happens to the gain? And I'm trying to figure this out. How could this be, Dick? I can't see such discrepancies. I know Chip Cohen. I mean, I met him, and he seemed like a pretty level-headed guy, over.
Yeah, I spent an afternoon with him back in, I think it was 2003 or 2004, at his place of business in the Boston area. awful nice guy, nice laboratory, whole bunch of computers all running in a supercomputer, a hypercube, so to speak. He had a whole bunch of relatively inexpensive desktops all hooked together doing these calculations for the fractal antennas that were his product line and to satisfy his individual customers at that time. And as a meandering technique, fractal has got something to offer. As a way of getting extra gain, no matter what he says, no matter what is written on the subject, I start off very skeptical. Because, let me backtrack, let me drop for a second. In a case of an amplifier, I apply power to it. I give it 15 volts at an ampere, and it's got a bunch of stages of gain. And so I put in a milliwatt, and if it's got 30 dB of gain, I get out a watt. Because I have put power into it, it can have real gain. The signal coming out can be stronger than what goes in. No reasonable antenna you and I use, Mel, do I put B-plus into it. I don't give it 15 volts. I don't give it an ampere. The only way it can have gain, you could say, is to have lack of loss. The energy that normally would be spread out from an isotropic antenna, our isotropic antenna, which goes in all directions like a light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. That's an isotropic antenna. If my particular antenna acts like the reflector on a flashlight, it takes the whole back hemisphere of energy and refocuses it forward. That focusing action is where the gain comes from. That's the only thing an antenna can do. If it's giving you gain in some direction, it's got to give you a lot less gain in some other direction. It has no choice. To do that phenomena requires real estate. That reflector on your flashlight is 1,000 wavelengths wide, and boy, it can do a good job of focusing. If I set up a good parabolic dish antenna for a UHF frequency, I'm probably going to make the parabolic dish at least 3 wavelengths wide and 3 wavelengths high. That gives it the real estate. That gives it the ability to have directivity, to aim the signal in one direction versus another. Let me drop. But if you're starting off with an antenna 8 inches wide, where on 2 meters the wavelength is 19 inches, 38, 72, something like 72 inches. The wavelength is 72 inches, and my fractal antenna is only 8 inches wide. It's a sixth of a wavelength wide and a sixth of a wavelength high. It doesn't have the real estate to have any directivity. I don't care if you gold-plate it and you put platinum in there and you breathe on it heavy and you give it a nuclear source. I don't care what you do. It doesn't have the real estate to have significant directivity. It doesn't have the ability to have gain over a dipole. I can make it an infinitesimal dipole, and in one direction, I can get damn close to dipole gain out of an infinitesimal dipole. But that's it. If I'm going to use multiple dipoles to try to get more directivity, they've got to be some good fraction of a wavelength apart, otherwise they don't give me the directivity. I can put those two infinitesimal dipoles on 2 meters, a half inch apart, and that's really one dipole, as far as Mother Nature is concerned. She doesn't see two dipoles until you start separating them. The physical size of this antenna you're describing isn't there. Unless an awful lot of measurement error was taking place, it couldn't have happened. And even if it was measurement error, it's not real. So the physics I know of where gain comes from is not there. I'm having a lot of trouble with it, as you can tell. I can tell you're having trouble with it. I think there's some error here. We're either misinterpreting, or maybe Chip made an error. He's an honest guy, but he can make an error. Over to you, Mel, K2LAW.
Roger, that's possible. This is K2KEY. However, in the article it states, he says that because we're so used to constructing antennas using Euclidean geometry that has dominated the antenna field for some years, that we have become completely, you know, devoid of any ideas of new designs if it isn't based on Euclidean geometry, which means planes, circles, triangles, squares, ellipses, rectangles, hemispheres, and paraboloids. So, now he's quoting another thing here about Walt Maxwell, some of his work that touched upon some antenna designs, and gets into some lot of mathematics here, which I'm not going to go into, you know, unless I break it down and see what the heck it's all about. But supposedly, this was applied to the LMEC program. And again, that's what's stated. And now, a year later, I'm on 2 meters. And I now have a continuous link to my DX packet cluster with my 1-watt walkie-talkie, which I could not do with any antennas in my previous location where I lived. I tried everything. No rubber duckies, no squares, no ground planes, no nothing. Nothing worked until I sat down one day using glue and construction paper and aluminum foil, and I made this complex-looking fractal microstrip antenna with this pergoda motif. The experience was unlike cutting out paper dolls, I guess. And the antenna wound up at 6 inches on its side at the time. Lacking even an SWR meter, I had no idea if it really would work. I took it outside on my window, on my railing, and what, you know, full quieting into the repeater, something I've never achieved before, Dick. Over.
Okay, this concept now, Mel, has been around for a significant number of years. If all that extra gain comes from that magic shape in that very small number of wavelengths of outer dimension, if all that gain was really there, wouldn't you and I see a whole lot of commercial products experiencing all this extra gain? How many commercial products can you buy that claim that extra gain? Mel, back to you.
That's the point. And the following in the end here, it says, F.M. Landsdorfer says that we shall see in a few years now amateur radio antennas, new design of amateur radio antennas. He hopes to bring out a whole bunch of just new designs for the first ham antennas based on fractal. And in fact, the ship went ahead and experimented with one that he shows here. What is this one for? 6 meters. Look at that, 30 inches on a side, 6 meters. And claims again, let's see, they're again starting out with this zero iteration called the quad, zero iteration, a quarter wavelength, quarter wavelength, ground plane, and now with these M11 and M12, and he found that with the M13 design of the 6 meter, he has a 1.2 dB gain over the quarter wave of vertical, Dick, by using the Minkowski M13 design. Over.
Okay, here he's talking about a small fraction of a dB of gain increase over a quarter wave antenna. That strikes me possible. But on the previous antenna on 2 meters, once you're talking about a 5 decibel increase compared to a cubical quad, and the cubical quad has got a fraction of a dB of gain increase compared to a dipole. So he's making it sound like the previous 2 meter antenna was something like 6 dB of gain over a dipole and only 8 inches square. Boy, everything I know says that that can't be, Mel. And now the 6 meter version, which you said is 36 inches long, 3 feet long, where a half wave dipole in that band would be 9 feet long. If he's talking about gain, a fraction of a dB different from a dipole, I'm going to give him that. But the previous one, 5 or 6 dB above a cubical quad, or above a dipole, 5 and a fraction dB above a cubical quad, I'm having a lot of trouble with that one. How come the 2 meter version had so much more gain compared to its reference compared to the 6-meter version. What happened? Back to you, Mel.
6-meter version was a small antenna considering because he only had room, you know, for 30 inches on a side, the 6-meter antenna. 30 inches, Dick, on a side. And even to have any gain of 30 inches over a quad, a single quad element, to me, it would be, you know, I mean, comparing sizes, I mean, you know, we're going to a very small, you know, piece of equipment, piece of construction, as compared to, you know, I could say, a 6-meter quad. So this is only 30 inches on its side, and it exhibits, he says, if we use the quad as 0 dB, he says here, and in fact, he used that as his reference, a 6-meter quad element, one element, in other words, calls it a quad, actually. In other words, he starts out with a piece of wire that would encompass a full wave on 6 meters. Now he starts bending it into this shape, this fractal shape called the M, what do you call it, M12, the M12 for 6 meters, and he exhibits a 1.5 dB gain over that, over the quad, single element, just by bending the wire up and making it now from its original size, what, about 50, what is a full wave on 6 meters? How long, Dick, the wire exactly?
A full wave on 6 meters is a little bit more than 18 feet. So a four-sided cubical quad would be 1/4 of 18 feet, maybe 4.5 feet on a side. There's something else that's bothering me, Mel. Between 6 meters and 2 meters, there's almost a 3-to-1 frequency ratio. So when I go down from 2 meters to 6 meters, most dimensions should increase by not quite 3-to-1. The 2-meter antenna with this 5 and a fraction dB of extra gain was 8 inches on a side. When I go down to 6 meters, if I multiply 8 times 3, it's only 24 inches on a side. I'll give you a little bit more and I'll let you make it 30. So it is larger in wavelengths, the 6-meter version, than was the 2-meter version. And the 2-meter version had all this great performance, 5 and a fraction dB more gain, and the 6-meter version is even larger in wavelengths. Why doesn't it also have 5 and a fraction dB more gain? What happened? When I went to the lower frequency, where things usually work better, I get less skin effect, I get less resistivity problems, I get less dielectric loss problems. Why don't I get the same performance? What happened? How about you, Mel?
Okay. I want an explanation, because the 2-meter one is based on the Minkowski M13 design, while the 6-meter version is based on the Minkowski M12 design. Why? I have no idea. Why do you go from one design to another? They are completely looking different antennas. Dick, you look at these things, it looks like a joke, the way these things are bent, you know, like something like, you know what it is? I think it would be great for like After Dark on your monitor there, you know, these crazy designs you can come up with. It looks like things like that to come up there. Why the 6 meters M12 and the 2 meters is M13, I have no idea. Dick, I this whole thing is somebody's got to sit down and explain all this stuff. The design and the sizes and all, I'm not sure I understand maybe fractal mathematics the way I should, over.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta with a comment.
Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Dick. I have a theory on all this. And I think it has to do, I think one of the key elements in all this is that the 2-meter antenna was placed in an apartment or outside an apartment window accessing another transceiver, another packet node or whatever that was 30 miles away. That to me sounds like that's a path that's ripe with multipath. And when he took this antenna and put all the little bends in it, he reduced the directivity of that antenna over what it had originally. when he reduced the directivity of it, he caused that antenna to be more susceptible to multipath reception. And if he happened to have that antenna in just the right position, he might have been picking up the signal from different, reflected off different buildings and off the ground and off the roofs of other buildings and things like that. He had it in just the right sweet spot. I can see where an antenna with low gain would produce a stronger signal than an antenna with gain in that same position. So I think the numbers don't make sense because of this reason, and I think if you really test this on in free space or in a real antenna lab, I think you'll really see what's going on. I think you'll see that the gain in that case would be much lower than a full-sized antenna. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. You've got a good possible explanation for what was happening. So it is a kind of naive, innocent measurement error that may have taken place. Let's see if we can squeeze in Dave. N2APG, Dave, why don't you give us your question? We've got 7 minutes left. See if we can squeeze you in. You got it, Dave. N2APG, K2RAW.
K2RAW on the net, N2APG. Plenty of time for my quick stuff. Two things I wanted to just go over. Number one, when you were talking to Mr. RYY about the Yagi antennas, the UHF Yagi antennas, you made a statement about using an antenna, the performance curve. You said that to use a higher frequency designed antenna on a lower frequency, I believe you said that was better than using the lower on a higher. Could you just go over that again real quick, and then I have an astronomy thing.
You got it right, Dave. If I take a Yagi, I'm going to pick a number out of the air. The Yagi has got peak gain at 440 megacycles. I really peak the living daylights out of it, and it works like a charm at 440 megacycles. Then I decide to slowly walk up toward 450 megacycles and plot the performance. And in the second experiment, I start at 440, and I walk down to 430 megacycles, and I plot the performance. You'll find out that when you go up in frequency by doing nothing but just change the frequency of the signal generator on a Yagi that's peaked at 440, at first not a hell of a lot happens, but all of a sudden it runs into a cliff on the high side. On the low side, the gain falls off in a much more gradual manner. That's just a characteristic of Yagis. I could go into why, but just take my word for it. So if you go up in frequency on the way you're using a Yagi, it's got a cliff. It's got a sudden fall off real sharp. On the low side, you can get away with a lot more murder. Back to you, Dave.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I wanted to just clarify that because, that has a lot of practical application because how many times you go to, a good ham fest like a horse trader's or something like that, and there's plenty of, nice commercial UHF Yagis available for, a couple of bucks. And for what you're saying, to use them on an amateur band, wouldn't be a major problem. If they're designed, say 450, 470, to use them on the ham band probably would be, not a problem at all. The second thing I just wanted to mention, I just wanted to give everybody a heads up, those that are into astronomy and things like that. Starting tomorrow night, the International Space Station is going to be making some beautiful passes in the evening for us here in the Northeast. Sometimes two passes a night, and most of the passes are pretty bright, minus one, minus two, sometimes even minus three magnitude. So anybody that would like to see that, all the information's on the Heavens Above website.
I have a list right in front of me. I'll read it out if you want.
Yeah, many of those passes are around, roughly 8 o'clock at night, Joe? Go ahead.
Let's see. According to the list, actually there was one tonight at 8:28, 2 minutes duration, 34 degrees above the horizon. So we missed that, certainly. Tomorrow, Monday night, September 7th, 8:52 p.m., 3 minute duration, 61 degrees above the horizon, maximum. Starts at 10 above west-southwest and ends at 57 above north. You want the one for Tuesday also?
Yeah, fire away.
Tuesday, September 8th, 7:42 p.m., 5 minutes duration, 36 degrees maximum elevation, 11 above south, southwest, ending at 10 above east, northeast. What else do we have here? Oh, there's another one for Tuesday also. 9:19 p.m., less than 1 minute duration, 23 degrees maximum elevation, 22 above northwest, 23 above north, northwest departure. And last one I have listed is Wednesday, September 9th, 8:07 p.m., 5 minutes duration, 57 degrees maximum elevation, 10 above west-southwest arrival, 11 above northeast departure.
Yeah, part of what's going on here is that the orbit of the shuttle is very desirable compared to our sunset, so that we're going to be in partial darkness, but it's up at a higher altitude, and the sun is shining on it, nice and bright. Second of all, it's going to be oriented in such a way that the echo that we get off of the solar panels is quite good. The space shuttle and the International Space Station are linked together until Thursday, so there's two objects there. Put it all together, you get a very bright object that sweeps across the sky in a nice, steady, white dot, so to speak, if you're not using a whole lot of magnification. And it's an interesting thing to look at. I wonder how many of these have you seen, Dave, and what it looked like from your point of view. N2APG, K2RIW.
I try to watch it as often as I can. I was looking tonight, but it was cloudy. It's you know, minus 2, minus 3 is fantastic. So it's great optical astronomy, and it's easy to spot, you know.
Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
Unfortunately, as you can tell, the machine cut us off. I'm now talking on the eastern input in order to come out of the machine so that you guys can hear us. What you just heard was TechNet number 1260. Mel's not going to be able to make it to the eastern machine, so I'll have to say goodbye for Mel. As I said, TechNet number 1260 is what you just heard. Be kind to each other. Try to help the people in Bayville understand that radio is good. 73 you all, and we'll be back next week. KQRIW, TechNet, Limark, we're clear. Bye-bye, you all. And through the eastern machine, but you're not going to be coming through the western machine when you're using the 2-5 input. Go ahead.
Guys, N2APJ.